Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Houston 127, Golden State 105. And if you watch game one, you were probably pretty surprised by what you saw last night. Now, one guy who was not surprised was Warriors coach Steve Kerr. He's seen this before. You could tell during that in-game interview that he was concerned about how his team showed up in the first quarter, and then that did not change throughout the game. So, exactly what happened to Golden State last night? I have thoughts. I'll give you my thoughts, but I think I'll go ahead and let Steve Kerr answer that first.
Give them the credit. They came out and played a great game, and they got everybody going, and so they got, we got what we deserved. So, they kicked our butts, no other way to say it.
Boy, that sounds like a guy, doesn't it, who played for Phil Jackson. He started off by saying, give them some credit. He didn't say it exactly the way Philip did back in the day, but he sounds like a guy who played for Phil Jackson.
You give them some credit, I mean, for real.
Right, for real. And Steve Kerr is right. Houston did kick Golden State's butts, and there's really no other way to say it. Well, another way to say it is things like that happen. They kick their ass. But things like that do happen. Teams that win 65 games in the regular season and have a couple of Hall of Famers in their starting five are usually pretty good teams. They rarely get swept in the playoffs. Things like that happen. And especially when Houston's going to come out with everything they had the way they did. They were good in the first quarter. They were even better in the second quarter. And then they braced themselves because if there's anything we know about Golden State, they usually ball out in the third quarter. But Houston knew that was coming, and they even managed to win that quarter too. I'll tell you what it comes down to. Houston played like their playoff lives and their entire season depended on it. Not only that, but like legacies, reputations. All of it came down to that game. It was all on the line. They played as if all of that was at stake because it was. Golden State, though, played that game and approached that game like it was some midweek second game of a back-to-back against the Pistons in January. Golden State was sloppy. Sloppy defensively, sloppy offensively, and then when Houston got physical with them, they did not respond. Or as Draymond Green put it,
I just think our game plan discipline wasn't good. You know, we knew what type of force they would come out with. It's nothing we haven't seen before. We just didn't have a really good game plan discipline.
Right. I mean, they knew what kind of force they were going to come with, and they still didn't match it at all. I mean, Golden State was loose with the ball on offense. They were a mess on defense. They kept getting into bad matchups. They were reaching. They were giving up and ones. And this is key, Houston was finding Steph Curry, and Houston was going right at Steph Curry. Now, Steph will tell you he's okay. Steve Kerr will tell you Steph is okay. But to me, he doesn't look like he's okay. Put another way, Steph does not look like Steph. And James Harden and Chris Paul are attacking him every chance they get. Now, let's not get this twisted. Houston is a good team. They're a really good team. Bad teams don't win 65 games, but when P.J. Tucker is lighting you up for 22 on 8 of 9 shooting, that's a sign that they're doing something well and you're doing something wrong, really wrong. I mean, when P.J. Tucker is looking like dead-eye Steve Kerr in his prime in a Western Conference Finals game, that's pretty interesting. Just as Nick Young getting 17 minutes in a Western Conference Finals game is pretty interesting. Hell, there was even a Joe Johnson sighting when things really got out of hand. And while it was not a good Warriors performance by any stretch, it is important to remember this. And this is what they do. This is what Golden State does. They've got games like this. They have games like this every so often. You know, like, I don't know, game three against New Orleans when the Pelicans smashed them by 19. Now, these Rockets are not those Pelicans. But to the Warriors, I'm not so sure. To Golden State, when they went into Houston and they ripped the home court the way they did, Houston didn't look like much of a threat. So last night has got to be a big wake-up call for Golden State because Houston can score. That was never in doubt, even after everybody freaked out about their strategy offensively in game one. The big difference last night, though, was Houston locked in defensively. Klay Thompson was not getting those open looks where nobody was within 10 feet of him. They were getting crushed on the glass, and Steph only had 1 3. As a team, they only had 9. So, bottom line, what's it all mean? Golden State still got the split. Golden State is still going back to Oracle with the home court. Golden State is still in the driver's seat. But Game 3 got a little bit more interesting. No, check that. A hell of a lot more interesting. And from the looks of things, we might just get the series that we have all been waiting on. And that is not something that I would have said or did say after Game 1.
Kicked our butts. No other way to say it.
No other way to say it. Kicked our butts. Just got a whole lot more interesting. That was me giving myself a tongue. I like my analysis of Game 1. Hey, look. I have not been giving myself enough credit lately. I know none of you have been giving me enough credit lately. If you want credit, just take it. I mean, give me some bleeping credit.
Give them some credit. I mean, for real.
Give me some bleeping credit, for real. You're joined by Gabe Kapler. Gabe, it is so good to have you on the program. How are you?
Jim, I'm doing great. So nice to talk to you. It's been a long time.
It's been a long time, Gabe, and I know you're joining me from the dugout in Busch, which I really appreciate. Let me ask you about last night's game first. Gabe, you're coming off a 4-1 win over the Orioles, where your starter, Nick Pivetta, went 7. He allowed 2 hits. He had a career-high 11 strikeouts. What do you make of the performance that you got from him last night?
Jim, good pitchers make adjustments, in my mind, and Nick, from spring training through today, has made a ton of them. He's utilizing his breaking balls really effectively, and they've been nasty. He's got 2 of them. He's got a curveball and a slider, and both of them have been really effective. He's using an explosive fastball at the top and the bottom of the zone that he's throwing for strikes, and that's what he's been working on since spring training, kind of working with a north-south attack, essentially top of the zone to bottom of the zone, doing a really good job. He's right where he needs to be.
And he's just 25, so I know the future is very bright for him, and I know you've got high expectations for it. You know, Gabe, that win took the team to 8 games over 500. It's the first time since 2011. I know it's your first season. I know you can't speak to what happened before you got there, but when you're coming into a situation where a team has suffered a lot of losses, how valuable is it to get off to a start like this?
It's huge. It's huge. And with that, the character of the club begins to emerge. So what I've noticed about our men recently is we're focused. And our staff and our players, they prepare like animals, but they also know how to keep it light and be themselves. So in the dugout, they're smiling and laughing. In the clubhouse, after games, they know how to celebrate. They know how to turn the page. That's critical. They come back to the ballpark the next day after a loss, act like it didn't happen, enjoy being around each other. So those things that I just mentioned, some of that character plus talent, and obviously you can't do anything without talent, equal a pretty good start for us. Really proud of the guys.
Right. Character plus talent may equal culture, which we'll get to in a minute. Gabe Kapler, my guest. Now, coming into the season, the sense outside the organization, Gabe, was that you were building something and it was going to turn around. But I'm not sure how many people outside that clubhouse expected you to be 8 games over 500, just 40 games in. But you believed the team was ready to take a big step. What did you see that made you feel that way?
So, first of all, keep things in perspective, right? We're kind of at the quarter point of the season. So we understand that we have a long way to go. We never lose sight of the fact that, you know, we are only just beginning. But what we've seen so far, to answer your question directly, is we've seen a good offense, and it's the kind of offense that grinds the opposition down and can do damage. See a lot of pitches, and then we force pitchers to put the ball in the zone. When they do put the ball in the zone, we slug mistakes. We have some mix-and-match weapons in the bullpen, and as you mentioned at the top with Nick, we have some horses at the top of our rotation between Knowles, and Arrieta, and I'm speaking to Aaron Nola, Jake Arrieta, and then Nick Pivetta, with a couple of guys who, if they continue to develop, and Vince Velasquez, who goes tonight, and Zach Eflin, we've got a pretty good team top to bottom. So I think the start is just indicative that we have good talent.
Phillies manager Gabe Kapler, my guest. Now, Gabe, you and I have spoken a lot over the years, and it's very clear that you have a strong philosophy and an approach in the way you go about things. Now, there were some questions from the outside about the moves and decisions you made early on. How did you go about dealing with that and continuing to trust your own process?
That's a really good question, because I do think it's a balance between trusting the process and being responsive to the environment. So the first thing I did is I kind of listened to the voices. Listen to the people that were questioning some of the ways we were making moves in game. And I was responsive to it, right? Like I listened to it, I allowed it to soak in, and I just used it as a way to challenge myself to get better and to be more prepared. At the same time, the approach that we're taking is not that different, right? Like there are a lot of managers who are matching up with their best relievers in the highest leverage situations by way of example. I'm really not that much different from these other managers. Played baseball my whole life. been in major league dugouts for a long time as a player, minor league dugouts as a manager and as a farm director. I feel most comfortable in a baseball uniform, and I share a lot in common with what the other managers around the game are doing. It's just kind of, for whatever reason, identified as I'm doing things a whole lot differently with in-game strategy, and I don't really think that that's all that accurate, Jim.
Clones, cops are stepping up enforcement on motorists who are not wearing their seatbelts. If you've thought to yourself, I'm not going very far, or I'm in a rush, or seatbelts are just too uncomfortable, then know this. You're putting yourself at the risk of injury or death. And if you think that you're safe, unbuckled in that backseat, you are wrong. Over half the passengers killed in a 2016 crash were unrestrained. So even if you're in the backseat, you have to buckle up. You know the saying. Now make it a household rule to live by. Click it or ticket. When you're not wearing your seatbelt, you're risking serious injury or death. It's a fact. Cops are writing tickets, so don't take the risk. Don't play the odds. Again, let me say it so it sticks. Click it or ticket. You know, Gabe, one more point that I'd make. I mean, let's be honest. You were a 57th round pick in the MLB draft. You're the only 57th round pick to reach the majors, so you're not afraid of adversity. I knew you would stay the course. However, a number of the vets on the team said that they really liked the way you handled that. Carlos Santana said, quote, "We have his back. We had his back then, but we really have it now. He's a guy you want to play for. He's a guy you want to win for." So, Gabe, I bring that up because I knew you'd stay the course, but how much does it mean to you to have that kind of relationship with the players, especially your vets?
I don't think there's anything more important, and I'm really glad that you presented it the way you did. Obviously, that's a huge compliment to hear those things that Santana was saying, and I don't take it lightly. I think one of the reasons we're able to develop those relationships is by staying committed to them and having conversations even when they're not comfortable. So by way of example, with Santana, there are days that I want to give him a day off. And you know what he says? He says, I don't want a day off. I want to play 162 games. So we don't just leave it at that. We have a discussion one day, and then we have it the next time I want to give him a day off. And I think that open line of communication, an office that is always open to having healthy, direct, honest conversations, creates those long-term relationships where we want to fight for each other, Jim. For me, it's kind of simple. It does take a lot of work, and you mentioned the word process. You have to be committed to it every day, but I do think it's valuable.
We're talking to Gabe Kapler. You know, Gabe, one of the topics that keeps coming up when I talk with managers who are having a lot of success right now is the relationship they have with their players, making sure that there is an environment for communication. You just said so yourself. To that point, you want to make sure that your office in Clearwater was a place where guys would hang out. Why is it something that you wanted to invest time and effort into, and why is that so important?
That's great. Well, so not just the office in Clearwater, but also the office in Philadelphia.
Okay.
I remember walking into a manager's office and it kind of feeling a bit like a principal's office, right? Where there's like the big mahogany desk, this figure behind it that's kind of, I don't know, authoritative. And I think a manager's office should be the opposite of a principal's office. When a player thinks about the office, I want him to think of it as a place where good news is shared and where positive conversations are had. And so that's how we focus. We focus on that in the office in Philadelphia, in Clearwater, in our clubhouse space. We want it to be a positive environment.
Gabe Kapler joining us. Gabe, you had a great quote when you told Sports Illustrated, "I'm not a golfer. I don't fish. I don't even watch TV. You give me a block of 2 hours, I want to sit down and drink coffee and scour information just because I'm interested in it. This is my happy fun time," end quote. I mean, I love that. What are some of the things that you like to research, and then how do you apply that knowledge to your life and to your work?
That's awesome. My mom always asks me, she always asks me as a manager, she says, are you having fun? And the word fun is just kind of, it's just a weird word for me. I enjoy myself, but it's not like the roller coaster kind of fun, like, I don't know, jumping out of an airplane, whatever you classify as fun. I like to go to a coffee shop or a really nice restaurant. I like to pull out my iPad, and I like to research articles on fitness or health or, you know, optimize for being just better at life in general. But then the other part of my time is usually scouring internet stuff like Fangraphs or some of the things that you're saying or things that other reporters are saying. I just want to learn as much as I can. I guess I'm just curious in general.
Yeah, speaking of fitness, I'm glad you brought that up, but I was going to get there anyway. I mean, being a manager is more than a full-time job. It would be easy to let other parts of your life slip, such as your own health and fitness, but you've been staying on that. Why is that so important?
Well, first of all, I got to be open. It's suffering, right? Like, the workouts, I'm still getting them in, but they're turning into these multitasking sessions where I'm listening to a rehab start. Like, by way of example, before I came in the dugout to talk to you, I was in our weight room here in St. Louis, and I had my earbuds in, and I was listening to Victor Arano's rehab outing in Lehigh Valley in AAA because I wanted to be aware of what was going on with him. So it's not like when I was, you know, 28 and got to just have the workouts to myself. I will say this. If you want your players to be healthy and strong and think about things like nutrition and think about things like training, you have to kind of walk the walk. So I'm not perfect by any stretch. It's not as good as it once was in terms of my diligence in the weight room with my sprints and my exercise regimen. But I do feel it's important to walk that walk.
You know, obviously, Gabe, you've got the benefit of being with a team, so they're going to look out for the players and for their staff. What about nutrition? How do you eat now compared to when you became a manager?
I'm eating less, I guess, more than anything else, so a couple times a day. And that's, first of all, to be efficient, but also because I'm just a little bit hungry less, and I can find that two meals satisfy me. But we haven't made many changes to the food in the clubhouse in Philadelphia. In fact, I came into a really good food culture that was already thriving. And so we have this incredible chef. We have an incredible nutritionist. The food in the clubhouse is outstanding. And more than anything else, I've just acted as a support system and endorser of healthy food in our environment.
A food culture. I love that. I need to improve my own food culture. One last thought. When you were playing, and because you're approaching this, you know, you might say I'm not coming at it so differently, but I think you are coming at it with a certain kind of energy that I haven't seen before. When you were playing, who were some of the managers who had the biggest impact on you?
I think Johnny Oates was a big impact because he was so calm and cool. I just never saw him lose control in the dugout or in the clubhouse. Never even heard him raise his voice. He's very encouraging. Joe Maddon comes to mind absolutely as a guy that knew how to make players feel like $1 million, like the best version of themselves. And I wasn't a very good player, Jim, but every time I was in Joe Madden's presence, I felt like I was a good player, and that was important to me. Tito Francona always had a real strong demeanor. I always looked down from one end of the dugout at him, and he was always smiling. I guess all of my managers had important influences on me, and one of my minor league managers, his name was Dwight Lowry, had a strong, charismatic presence as well that to this day I remember as having a big impact.
All right, once again, somebody pull the world off the Seattle Mariners because nobody anywhere is having a worse week than these cats are. First, they find out that their best hitter, their most important player, is getting 80 games of hard time for allegedly being a dirty drug cheat. On top of that, the rest of the non-Bull Reuters, not Bull Riders, Reuters, have had to step into the box and then what? To get worked, to get carved, to get embarrassed by who else? Big Sexy.
I'm sexy and I know it.
Bartolo Colon. Bart freaking Colon. 44 years young and still wrecking major league lineups. And the Mariners. Yesterday's line was filthy. 7 2/3. 4 knocks. No earned runs. 3 strikeouts. That dust job of the Mariners dropped his ERA on the year. Now wait for this. Bart's ERA for the season, 2.82. That's right. Big Sexy. sub 3 right now as a 44-year-old man. Hey, Robbie Cano, I see you working. If you're going to get popped right before you have to stand 60 feet, 6 inches from Bart Colon. Heady play, Rob. Heady play. Nice job, Robbie. Big Sexy. Spitting in the face of Father Time. And spinning age-defying gems. That's nothing new. It's what this dude does. It's who he is. But how about this? How about some bleeping credit? Bleeping credit for his defense. For real. I said his defense. It's one thing to field your position. It's another to do this. You don't believe me? Check this. Bottom of the fourth. 0-1 pitch from Bart. Check out the line drive.
And here a hot shot knocked down by Cologne. It's just in front of him. He picks it up on the front slope of the mound, gets it over to first in time for the out. But that one looked like it stung Bartolo a little bit.
And let's hope Bartolo Cologne is all right. That ball hit hard off of Cologne. He got the out.
I'll tell you what, he's a great athlete, though. I think he gets his glove on this. This is a rocket back at him. And he didn't get his glove on. No.
but I mean, you know, I mean, he's got a little protection there, you know.
He's got a little bit. That ball's hit hard. Have you been hit before?
Oh, yeah.
Look at him. He's grabbing his belly like, hey, it hit me. Yeah. You said he had some protection.
He got some protection there. I put, like, hey, since I haven't played this last year, I got a little protection.
That's not right.
Texas Rangers Radio, Fox Sports, Rangers, credit everybody. Yeah, I love that. Bartolo Colon knocks it down. Oh, he didn't knock that down. He got hit in the gut. That was a line drive to the gut. Exit velo has never been a more meaningful stat than it was right there. 101 miles per hour off the lumber and straight into the gut. A big sexy. 101 miles per hour. And Bart didn't die. The ball did. My man's stomach ate that pill up and spit it straight to the ground, right in front of him for an easy throw over to first. I'm telling you, I have officially seen enough. Send this dude his gold glove, or his gold gut, or his gold lap band, or whatever the hell it is you send to somebody who swallows 101 mile per hour comebackers with a spare tire. And while you're at it, save on the shipping cost and send him his AL MVP too, because he deserves that as well. Normally, when you see a pitcher getting tattooed by a comebacker, you don't see that same dude literally laugh off the training staff who comes on a dead sprint from the dugout to make sure that guy's still alive. That's exactly what Bart did. This guy laughed at the horrified medics and then continued on with his best outing of the year. The only thing better than Big Sexy using his breadbasket as a backstop was the quote after the game. The important thing is, we won the game. He got me on the side. It was not in the middle. And I have a big belly, so I can handle it. Oh, man's the best. He's the best, and it's not even close. He is a national treasure. And a hell of a goalie also. Because that's what he looked like. He looked like some dude between the pipes, just wearing one off the gut. Except Bart doesn't have pads. Because according to him, he's already insulated enough. Big Sexy turns 45 next week. And instead of saying an early happy birthday, I think I would just say this. May you live forever, Bart. May you live forever, Bart. Never change. Never go gluten-free. Never go paleo. Just keep eating what you eat, keep doing what you do, and keep being the nastiest dude alive. We're joined now by D'Angelo Hall. D'Angelo, it's good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing good, Jim. It's been a while, buddy.
It's been a while, man. It's great to hear your voice. Let me ask you now. There's been reports, D'Angelo, the last couple of days that you've retired, but it's not 100% official. So where are you right now in terms of thinking about your future? Where's your head at?
I'm still weighing all my options. I don't really want to play, but if the right, situation comes around, then, I haven't ruled out totally playing. But I have been focused more on TV and, radio and things like that here the last couple of months. And so I'm really enjoying that. I'm really kind of looking forward to doing that. I'm looking forward to the next chapter. And so even though I haven't officially retired yet, that was kind of a false report, but I'm pretty close to officially retiring. But if the right situation comes around, I haven't totally ruled out getting back on the football field.
That makes sense. D'Angelo Hall joining us. Now the fact is, you have played football at the highest level for a really long time. It can be tough to walk away. So when the fall rolls around, and I heard what you just said, for the right situation maybe, but when the fall rolls around, do you get the sense that you might want to play again? Like if a team calls in August, how would you handle that? Would you take that phone call?
I'd probably take the phone call. You got to hear them out and kind of just see where they're coming from and see what they envision. But like I said, once I move on, I'm going to move on. I'm not going to pull a Jay Cutler and go ahead and get a TV job, and then a team called me, and then, you know, leave the TV job and go back and play football. For me right now, it's really just trying to figure out what national interest I do have, and just kind of weighing those options, trying to figure out what best fits me and my family, and you know, really going from there.
D'Angelo Hall, my guest. Listen, you've got a great personality. Broadcasting would obviously be a natural move. When you look at broadcasting, how would you approach that? I mean, would you want a studio gig? Would you want to do games? Would you want to do your own talk show? How are you going to approach broadcasting?
I kind of envision myself always kind of being like, you know, pregame show, studio type of format. I enjoy calling games. I enjoy watching games and commenting and kind of putting my own little spin and flair on it. You know, it's not a lot of DB guys who are, you know, in those booths calling games. It's more offensive-minded, quarterback kind of geared, quarterback-driven, you know, presence in that booth. And so to have a defensive guy and kind of his perspective, you know, I enjoy watching Rondé do it, and I still do. And so, you know, I think I would definitely bring a different vantage point to that arena, for sure.
Hey, listen, at the same time, it's not broadcasting or bust, right? I mean, you've shattered Bruce Allen in the past. You wrote up scouting reports at the Combine. Is there any part of you that might be interested in maybe getting involved with the team from a front office perspective?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I joke with Bruce all the time. That's the thing that's so frustrating. I enjoy so much. You know, I'm such a football junkie that, you know, I can see myself calling games. I can see myself in the studio analyzing, you know, the outcome of games or predicting games. I can see myself on the field coaching. I can see myself, obviously, in that front office capacity. And, I mean, I absolutely enjoyed myself at the Combine, just sitting there breaking down players and, you know, talking to our other scouts and front office guys and seeing how they saw guys and why. And then telling them why I see, you know, this guy being a little better than the other guy. And so, you know, I definitely could see myself in that front office exec role for sure.
D'Angelo Hall, my guest. One more thought about the future. You had a great quote earlier this week. You said, "I had a vision of a gold jacket, but the injuries the last couple of years have been very hard on me, so that's kind of out of the question now. But who's to say I can't get in there some other way? That's kind of my focus. Mm-hmm. I still want a gold jacket. Whether I can get one as an exec, a coach, I'm going to get me a gold jacket, a damn gold jacket, and believe that." End quote. You know, I love that. So the question is, and it's the same question for almost any athlete once they leave the game. You've got this fire. You've got this passion. You've got your drive. What do you do with it? How do you channel that once you're off the field?
You know, you try to put it in the right direction. You know, you try to, put all that energy, you know, in the right direction. And, you mentioned me wanting to be a front office guy. And I was like, you know, the closest thing to getting that, you know, because having never got a ring as a player, you know, it kind of goes on the same lines as getting that gold jacket. You know, you got to have rings. And I feel like, you know, that's why I kind of teeter back and forth on front office versus coaching versus TV, because, you know, I probably can't get a gold jacket on TV. And so I kind of always want to build a team like a Bill Polian and Charlie Cashley and some of those guys who've done it the right way from an executive standpoint. And so, when I met John Lynch before our game last year, I told him, ball out, man, because I'm rooting for you, you know, because guys like me, we need to have guys like you have success from playing to, you know, to the booth, to, you know, and to that front office role, because I think it'll open up a lot more doors for, you know, for a lot of us other guys who are trying to do those things, you know, like John Lynch and John Elway, actually.
D'Angelo, what about John Lynch? Are you at all surprised that he's having the kind of success that he's having right now? And what do you think about the job he's done there?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, I can remember sitting in production meetings with John Lynch and, you know, just how in-depth he knew our roster and, you know, the needs and the deficiencies we had. You could tell he had, you know, a great mind for the game of football. And I think some of that information got back to a lot of team owners and, you know, team presidents and GMs. And so, you know, it was a little shocking because I didn't even know that was something he was interested in. But when I saw he got the job and was paired with Kyle Shanahan, I was like, oh, man, that's a match made in heaven, you know, because those two guys are definitely going to be on the same page. Because that's the problem, you know, you typically run into is, you know, your head coach has a vision, your GM has a vision, and, you know, sometimes even the president has a vision, and instead of everyone being on the same page, they tend to bicker amongst each other about, oh, we should have got this guy. And so they, you know, they're not 100% behind the guy that they do get, as opposed to, you know, everyone being on the same page. And so John and Kyle, I mean, I think they're a great combination. I got to, you know, run up in their room a little bit at the combine and talk to them. And, you know, I think they're doing great things, and I think they're going to be a heck of a football team.
D'Angelo Hall, my guest. Listen, the point that you just made is a really, really good point. Was that an issue in Washington? Were guys not on the same page in terms of the coach and management and ownership?
No, I didn't see that firsthand. Obviously, I think everyone knows, you know, publicly what happened with the Scott McLuhan situation. And I don't even think a lot of players really knew how in-depth that situation went. But I felt like from top to bottom, you know, they all were on the same page. I think Scott got let go for other issues. But I never saw that firsthand. But I'm just speaking in general of most organizations. That tends to be, you know, kind of the problems that surface when it comes to, you know, a head coach, a GM, and a, you know, and a president. You know, if you can get them all on the same page, you'll be a pretty successful franchise. You look at those guys up in New England, even though Bill Belichick kind of runs the whole thing, but because he runs the whole thing, everyone's on the same page, and those guys have been the, you know, the face of consistency and success over the last 10, 15 years.
You know, when you talk about that yellow jacket in the ring, D'Angelo, I think you're one of the first guys I've ever heard say, hey, even if I have finished playing, that doesn't mean that I've finished chasing, that I still want that ring and I still want that yellow jacket, or there might be a way to get it. You know, the thing about the ring, is there, among players, is there a distinction between haves and have-nots, or do you look at the ring like, you know, it's not meant to be for everybody? Not everybody ends up in a situation where you can win a ring.
Yeah, I mean, I'm smart enough to know in this league, you know, you got to have some luck too. You know, it's not all about who's the best or what, who's the best team. Sometimes you just got to have some luck. The ball has to bounce your way. You know, you watch the Giants and those guys to win two Super Bowl rings. I was drafted with Eli. And, you know, you talk about winning two Super Bowl rings, and those guys barely squeaked into the playoffs, weren't the favorites by a long shot. Look at a Ben Roethlisberger who just luckily got to a Pittsburgh Steelers team who had one of the most dominating defenses of all time, and he's able to get one. And then he comes into his own, and then, you know, he leads them to, you know, to another one. And so, you know, sometimes it is luck, and I haven't been the luckiest guy when it comes to that. But, you know, I look forward to the future. You know, my mom always told me she had a vision of me, you know, walking on that stage, getting the gold jacket, and she's kind of said it for the last 15 years or so. And so I started believing it, you know, probably about five years ago. And then, you know, I got hit with the injury bug, and, you know, it's been kind of tough. But, you know, for me, I don't think guys really compare, you know, it's not like the NBA. I feel like in the NBA, a lot of the all-time greats do always say, oh, well, Charles Barkley doesn't have a ring, or this guy doesn't have a ring, as opposed to, you know, in the football world, we tend to just respect the game of the guy across from us. And, you know, if he's worthy, he's worthy. But, you know, me being a historian of the game, obviously I feel like, you know, anybody cases made of more when you have those rings. And so, you know, like I said, it's going to be hard for me to get in there right now, even though I was back in the day, the youngest guy to 30 interceptions, the youngest guy to 40. And over the past 6 years, I hadn't touched the ball. And so it's definitely been frustrating. But, you know, like I said, I look forward to either getting in there as an exec, as a coach. You know, some way I'm going to get into that Hall of Fame, though.
D'Angelo Hall, my guest. You and I could chop it up for another hour. Before I let you go, though, you talk about touching the ball. You've always been a ball hawk. I mean, we can go back to that legendary strip of Roscoe Parrish that set the tone in the 2003 win over number 2 Miami. How do you explain the ability to force turnovers? Like, is it a skill that you work on and develop, or how much of that is just natural ability and a knack that you're born with?
You know, it's a little bit of, you know, it's a little bit of both. You know, I've always wanted the ball, but I loved playing defense. I loved the aggressiveness and the physicality of it. You know, I loved being the tackler as opposed to getting tackled. And, you know, back in high school, I can remember making a play just like that play, except I was running straight. straight towards the running back, and I literally, instead of, you know, I went to tackle him, and when I formed him up to tackle him, I could feel the ball, and I'm like, wow, I'm feeling the ball right now. And so I just spin out with the ball in my hand, take it out of his hand. And I mean, it was so graceful, Jim. I mean, I'm gonna find that video.
Yes,
it was one of the most gracefulest plays I've ever seen. And I'm not just saying that because it's myself, but as a high school kid to do that, and then I mean, it just translated in college and in the league. And there's so many similar plays like that. You watch the Pro Bowl play where I strip Wes Welker, and I'm kind of forming him up, and I just, oh, I feel the ball, and I just pull it out and keep going. And numerous other plays through the course of my career has kind of been like that too. And I tell some of the young guys, like, man, when I go to tackle, I don't really tackle the guy. I try to tackle the ball. And, you know, it's a little bit of a knack for it, but at the same time, it's a little bit of practice as well.
Let me tell you something, D'Angelo, and you know I'm coming from a place of respect. That's why I love you, man. That's you. To me, the way you just answered that question was you in your prime. You are in the middle of your career right now. That was a graceful play, and I'm going to find it for you. I hope you do. Last thought. There was this awesome moment on the NFL Network set last month when Jim Mora, who coached you in Atlanta, was telling a story about you and Randy Moss facing in the preseason, facing each other. Mora was saying that he told you Moss was fast, and then Moss threw his hand up to signal Dante Culpepper, and as Mora is talking, you crash the set, and you were talking about that play. What do you remember about that specific play?
It is the reason I always say Randy Moss is the greatest player I have ever played against. Because, you know, you talk about me being a very cocky guy and feeling like I could stop anybody, I could run with anybody. I was an extremely fast guy. And to run up on a dude who makes you look like you're that makes you look like you don't even belong on the same field as him was a real humbling experience. And from that moment on, I knew that the NFL is not for little kids. It's for grown men. And I needed to grow up. I needed to learn technique and not try to go out there and just out-athletic everybody. And, you know, I really became a student of the game after that because, you know, hearing Jim tell me, I was like, all right, man, whatever, dude. But actually going out there and seeing it firsthand and getting exposed, I was like, I'm either going to be the hunted or the hunter. And from that moment on, you know, I tried to put my all into the game of football so that I did not become the hunted.
Tell you what, man, I can't get enough of this. I hate that this interview is over right now. 43 career interceptions, the only player in NFL history with 5 fumble returns for a TD and 5 interception returns for a TD as well, and still chasing the ring and the jacket. D'Angelo, man, so good to have you on the show. Let's do it again soon, and it's always great to have you here because you make this show better. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Jim. When I'm in L.A., I'm definitely coming out there. I'm coming in studio.
Can't wait to see you, man. I would love to have you, D'Angelo. You let me know. I'm going to clear everything out for you. Can't wait. All right, man.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, Jim.
Charles Robinson. My man, Charles, what's going on? How are you?
I'm doing well. Not as well as you. Hall of Fame nominated.
It being nominated is one thing, my man. Getting into another, right? Are you going to vote for me? Or is that a conflict of some kind of interest?
Hey, look, you'll have the Army organized. I think it'll be a landslide.
My man, good looking out. Appreciate you saying it. Charles, thank you. Great to have you back. Listen, when the Supreme Court came down with that decision on Monday, what do you think the reaction was among NFL owners and inside of that league office?
Well, you know, I think it was probably in some way split only because I think – here's the thing about NFL ownership that I think people have to understand is sort of the old guard of NFL ownership is starting to transition into, you know, younger guys that don't have – 20, 30 years of sort of familial ownership where the sort of archaic idea of gambling in the NFL and them having to be so exclusive from one another took root decades ago. I think that as time has gone on, you've started to see younger owners come in, you know, I want to say youngish owners in their, you know, 50s, 60s, guys who have had maybe business experience where they see attitudes on gambling softening. And I think they look at this as done in the correct way. There's a business opportunity here, the same way there was a business opportunity with fantasy football, the same way there was a business opportunity with the secondary scalping, you know, scalping market with the NFL tickets. So, you know, I think that that guard, the sort of willing to embrace some semblance of gambling around the game, has been growing, and that's part of why we saw the Raiders, you know, end up with the relocation push to Las Vegas, is the changing attitudes in the NFL, willing to accept those changing attitudes and also saying, hey, look, by 2027, we're trying to hit $25 billion in annual revenue. We have to be aggressive about the streams, and this is going to help.
Charles Robinson joining us, you know, to that point about the Vegas Raiders. Then you've got also the fact that three NFL teams have the same ownership as three English soccer teams where gambling is legal. And you're right, this thing is changing. Like, for instance, the NBA in particular has been much more proactive when it comes to embracing the possibilities of legalized sports betting. The NFL publicly now has been a little more cautious. Does that mean they're legitimately concerned about legalized sports betting, or are they concerned about maximizing what they can make off of legalized sports betting?
I think the deeper concern is maximizing it. I do. When they talk about, you know, regulatory reform, there are a couple of things you have to consider here. Is that a lot of this is going to be state driven, and the NFL knows, look, for us to cut as a league, for us to figure out exactly what we want to do with the gambling aspect, what cut we're going to get to do this on a state by state basis is very difficult. It's costly. You know, there's just a lot of legal regulation that you have to go through, but the far easier route is to, hey, let's start lobbying. Let's get lobbyists together and let's try to get some sort of overarching federal look at the gambling and what cut we can get, you know, through essentially what would be federal legislation. So when the NFL says, hey, regulatory reform, I think really what they mean by regulatory reform isn't just, let's make sure that gambling is separate enough from our game that we retain the integrity, that what you're watching isn't fixed in any way, shape, or form. I think the larger issue is, let's make sure that federally there's some sort of mandated cut that we're getting off of every single bet on our product. Now, will they come out and say that? Probably not. It's not a great PR look, but I think when you follow where the money goes and the lobbying goes and the push goes with the NFL and federal legislation, I think you'll see it's more about making sure that they get that cut consistently across all 50 states.
You know, and not only that, but how they position it, right? I mean, it's one thing to talk about, quote, ticket scalping, but then all of a sudden when ticket scalping becomes a secondary market, it doesn't look and feel quite the same way, right?
Right. There's an economy of language, no doubt. You don't want the NFL to say, hey, you know, we're getting into double dipping and you know, ticket scalping and essentially co-opting this entire market. What they say is, now we've got NFL Ticket Exchange, and guess what? It's safer for you to sell your tickets, you know, through this entity that we already have a deal with, or one of these, you know, nationally recognized ticket brokers that we do deals with, or teams do individual deals with. So, you know, I think there's going to be some element of that, as you said, that economy of language. How exactly do you spin it? And, you know, the big thing here, too, is, I think even the NFL has not quite figured out from a gambling aspect where the most money can be made. And I think it's because for so long, particularly just casual gamblers go, well, it's betting lines, it's over, under, you know, the spread or whatever. But I think people that the NFL, you know, has begun to talk to about where money, you know, can be made on gambling, particularly as it concerns smartphones and technology, is micro betting, play to play, series to series. Hey, all of a sudden, Game 16 for the Cleveland Browns when they're, you know, 0-15, you know, it still matters from kickoff to, you know, the final horn. It still matters. And, you know, I think the NFL knows that there's a lot of nuance in what's coming that they don't quite understand yet. But I would say this, for the first time in a long time, Mark Cuban, when he spoke and said, hey, double, triple, quadruple the price of sports franchises with this, I think the NFL and Mark Cuban actually agree on something. They know franchise prices are going to go through the roof over the next 10, 20 years.
Charles Robinson, my guest. I think that's really important what you just said, because this is not just a matter of, okay, now you can legally gamble. Now you can legally gamble and pick who you think is going to win and pick the over-under. This whole notion of micro betting, micro gambling, where you can bet on almost anything in-game. I mean, what do you think legalized sports gambling is going to look like with the NFL?
Well, I think with, you know, quote-unquote aggressive gamblers, you know, these are individuals that already go on Bovada and see a lot of the prop bets and all these things. They're familiar with it. I think for casual gamblers,
you're going to see people, you know, in other states that all of a sudden go, hey, it's not as hard. I don't have to seek out something online. It's not as difficult for me to place, you know, just a random, you know, run-of-the-mill sort of win-loss bet or point spread bet. But, you know, it's funny because when you hear people who are critics of gambling, they say, well, you know, is that gateway betting? Now all of a sudden are you going to learn what a prop bet is and you're going to become more of an aggressive gambler? I don't know. I mean, I don't know that the studies are necessarily there, particularly when it concerns sports gaming, to know, you know, how much this will really change the landscape. But it's new enough that, you know, it's hard to know exactly where this will take things. It's never, you know, you and I are used to having to go to Vegas or wherever else, particularly before technology existed to bring it to our front door, you know, to play sports bets. So, you know, it'll be interesting. I think the only undeniable fact that everyone can agree upon is that this is going to draw more eyeballs into games, particularly later in the season when they don't matter as much. And that's going to ultimately be good for the NFL's bottom line.
Well, not only that, but that Thursday night package, too, where it's the only game that's on, where everybody has to watch that game for sure. Listen, one last thought. What about the integrity of the game issue? For instance, the argument against the threat of a point-shaving scandal has been that players make way too much money for a gambler or a gambling ring to influence them on the professional level. Do you agree with that? Does that sound right to you?
I agree with that. And the thing is, too, I think the NFL is a little more hardened in terms of the difficulty it would be to fix an NFL game through a player. It's not like basketball, where we see a lot of point shaving scandals historically through games where there's a limited number of individuals involved in the actual product on the floor, the field, or whatever. The NFL, at any given time, you got 22 guys out there on a field, and it's really difficult unless you have the exact right placed person. It's probably easier to affect, I would think, through officiating. But I think this is really, in terms of, if you want to see where the NFL devotes some money in terms of infrastructure going forward to deal with this, I think you're going to see a lot of it, you know, on the 32 different club levels. Security will be ramped up. I think there will be more mechanisms to, you know, not only oversight in terms of what you're seeing on the field and, you know, what looks wonky and what doesn't. But then also, I think there's a chance that we could get full-time dedicated officials who are on the payroll, who have no other jobs, that are paid very, very well, and this is their job 24/7 to help to eliminate from, you know, maybe little side cracks that could develop. But there's going to be a lot of money that comes in and out of this, and you know, there are about a million questions to be answered. But I think security-wise, that integrity aspect, if the NFL devotes a lion's share of money, it will be to making sure that they've got a lot of oversight internally on that.
He is an excellent senior NFL reporter for Yahoo. You can follow him on Twitter at Charles Robinson. My man, thank you so much, Charles. Great job, and always good to have you on this show.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Roman. Congratulations.
Let's go to Fall City. Liz. Liz, what's going on? How are you?
Hey, Jim. How are you?
So good, Liz. How about you? How's life?
I'm great. Can you believe it's been 15 years since that tour stopped?
No.
And I remember it like it was yesterday. You came out on a orange Hummer. The baseball field, Dell Diamond, went crazy. I was a VIP in the Dos Equis luxury box, and it was incredible. There was a great tailgate party way before you even came out. So everybody was excited and lit. And cheers to another 15 years. You're like family to me, to all of us. Look at 12 Wood and Woodscopes. I mean, it's just, you're going to transcend forever. And I hope you'll go on Woodscopes one day. And I thank you for everything. And I hope you get in that Hall of Fame. You deserve it.
Liz, you are the best. Thank you so much. You're fam too, Liz. Appreciate you. Liz in Falls City. All right, back to the phones. The streak is over. The Lady Clone streak ends at 2. Let's go to Wisco. Speaking of Wisco, 12 Wood in Wisco. Woodrow, what's going on, Wood? How you doing?
Rome.
What's up?
I'm doing good. Yourself?
I'm good. Good, bud. How about you?
I'm doing really good. Hey, first of all, Liz, thanks for giving me the love on the radio. I love that. Jim, I had a question for you. I know we're all going to vote for you no matter what, but can we make an agreement? Like, if we get you in the Hall of Fame, you're coming on the Woodscopes that week or whatever, I mean, everyone wants you on. It's not just a me thing.
All right, so first of all, Wood, and Dew, you've done a good job of this, but for whatever reason, if somebody's listening right now and they do not know what the Wood Scopes is, what is the Wood Scopes?
Wood Scopes is a weekly show that I do on Periscope where I talk to semi-famous people in my basement on the phone, and you guys are watching on Periscope. Is like a chat room, a glorified chat room, where the background is actually a video of me and whatever I have in my background. Good time. Everyone's, it's like we can't get together because we all live in different states and whatnot, but it's a good time. We get
all right, the show, your show, is about this show, right? I mean, you're talking about this
Absolutely.
Show, or yeah. Are you talking about everything?
Yeah. I mean, because you've had me on here, I've had some incredible guests. I mean, it just keeps going on and on. I just got one of the coaches from the Last Chance University is going to be coming on pretty soon.
Great.
And I've had guys who were on documentaries on Netflix. It's unbelievable, dude.
Dude, that's amazing. That really is. So is the show booked for this week yet?
It is.
Who?
I got Jim Benton. Kyle's going to talk about his trip. Joseph's going to talk about his new show. Like, all these shows are sprouting out everywhere. It's awesome. And then we have Scott and Ventura. He's another clone.
Hey, bro, what about, before you get to me, you should get, I've got something that's as good, if not better than me, Alvin DeLauro. Have you been efforting Alvin?
I want Alvin almost as bad as I want Jim Rome.
You should want him more.
No, dude, no.
All right, so what time is the show on? And Wood, I know it seems kind of basic and a little bit insulting, but there are people who don't understand this whole notion of a scope. How do people get it? How do people watch it? Because I'm all about this. I really appreciate you and the fact that you do a show every week about this show. So how do people find it?
All right, the easiest way is to download the Periscope app. And you could sign in the same way you would with Twitter. So it's the same username and password. Subscribe to 12Wood. You could search me by either Wood Scopes or 12Wood, and then you'll get an alert when the show starts. It's 9 o'clock Central Standard Time, 7 o'clock for the California people. Otherwise, you can go to my Twitter page, and it's usually the first tweet up there on Friday night.
All right, so that's Friday night. And to answer your question, Wood, if you get me into the Hall of Fame, if you push and you lead that charge and you get me into the Hall of Fame, I will do the Wood Scopes.
Yes.
Maybe not the next day. But you have my word. Everybody listening right now, you find a way to get me into the National Radio Hall of Fame, and I will do the Wood Scopes. Promise.
All right, I'm holding you to it.
You got it,
bro. I'm holding you to it.
You got it. Listen, have a great show this week. Stay on it. I appreciate you, man. Thank you. 12Wood. 12Wood has done a show, or does a show every single Friday night about this show, and it's spawning other shows. Hey, listen, understand this. If you like the show and you need a place to congregate to talk about the show, that's one of the best places to do it. It's great. I've seen it now. I lurk sometimes. I check them out. Let's go to Jacksonville. Danica in Jayville. Danica, what's
Hello.
Going on? What's up?
Not much. Thanks for the vine. I have to say that of all the players who I would say deserve the MVP is LeBron James. He is literally dragging this Cavaliers team kicking and screaming through these playoffs. I mean, it is like a bad Space Jam plot where the Monstars come to steal talent from the Cavaliers only to find out that they don't have any. Outside of Love and LeBron, the three starters had a total of 11 points. 11. Don't know who the other guy is. J.R. Smith's game did an impression of Rodney Hood where it just refused to get off the bench and go in. And Tristan Thompson, he's too busy thotting it up to even play, you know. And I just say they won't be in. I don't see the Cavaliers going to the finals. I think this is. I don't know if this is it for LeBron in Cleveland, but oh man, that was it just breaks my heart. And also with Big Ben saying that he might have 3 more years, I really, really doubt that. And if you don't know when the time is to go out to pasture, the Jaguars can do it for you. I mean. We took out Dan Marino and Jim Kelly, and we could do that for you, too. So just hit us up later on this year. And before I go, Rome, I think I'm going to do my own tenderoni stop. I don't know when the date or time is, but clones can be ruined by the sweet, sweet sounds of Parody Larry's greatest hits. I'm out.
You racker.
Good night now!